The Ground Steward and the Orphans. Merrick woke to the sound of cocks crowing from the orphanage grounds. He opened his mouth and wiped the dry saliva from his lips with his palm, his hand still smelling like chicken from last night's meal. He opened the chamber door and found, as was the custom, an ewer filled with water, a basin, towel, mug, and a small bowl filled with powdered marjoram to rub on his teeth. He brought them in, removed the linens he had slept in, and washed his face and upper body, rinsing his mouth and cleaning his teeth. When he was finished, he dressed, went downstairs to the vestibule, and knocked on the curate's chamber door. A muffled voice said, "Enter!" The echo of a chant floated through the air. Barda stood before a captor, a hollowed-out section in the wall. Within the niche sat a small iron bowl. A wooden effigy stood behind it. Merrick had not noticed it the night before. The statuette was a wolf's head on a man's body, the symbol of Veles, god of trade and emissary to the underworld. The iron bowl's interior was covered in a sticky residue accumulated from years of being filled with honeyed mead. Breakfast had been placed on the table, a basket of boiled eggs, a wedge of cheese, and a loaf of bread. Merrick took a seat, cut a slice of cheese with his sacks, and tore off a hunk of bread. Barda walked over, grabbed an egg, and sat down. "Veles is our patron," he explained. "I was praying to him for guidance." "Veles is the patron of herdsmen and a trader of the underworld," said Merrick. "How is he your patron as well?" Barda gave a nod as he swallowed some of the egg. "He is not just the god of cattle, but of many wild animals. He takes the form of the bear or the wolf. He brings us music, and where his adversary, Perun, is god to people highborn, Veles has concern for the commoner. And who is more common than an orphan?" Merrick shrugged and nodded in agreement. "Did he answer your prayers?" "He did," answered Barda. "He gave me a sign. The winds have died down and snow is falling." "What was the sign for?" asked the ground steward. "For confession," answered Barda. "Last night I was not completely honest with you. We are accosted by bandits who demand payment, but the name of the man who comes and collects on their behalf is not Ferenc, but Felushi." Merrick cocked his head at the name. "I know a man named Felushi. He is the guild dean in Estagom and is as crooked as the Mester Road. Why give me the truth today and not last night?" "We were fearful. We'd been implicated in a crime and would be executed if not for the band's mercy. But if we speak of the same Felushi, then you know what he can do. I was not being rational. But we are resolved to make amends, to serve the ban as we should have, and to remove the black mark from our names," said Barda. "That mark runs deep," said Merrick, doubting the curate's sincerity. "The road to redemption is long, cleric. We will see how you journey along it." "Fair enough. One could ask for nothing less," said Barda. "I have had the prioress assemble the boys outside. Shall we inspect them?" Merrick nodded, rose, stuffed four eggs and the cheese into his pocket, and then followed Barda out of the tower. The Latia, as Barda had told him, had settled down but was still whipping about the plains, whistling as it rushed around the corners of the dilapidated buildings and the rickety stables. A light snow was falling, chaotically blown about by the winds. Small whirlwinds of snow sped across the courtyard, piling into a drift growing against the crumbling eastern stone wall. In front of the residence hall stood a row of boys aged between 10 and 13. Dressed in old clothing in shades of grey and brown, they huddled as close as they could, seeking warmth from the unforgiving gusts. All but one, a boy of 12 seasons or so, who seemed unbothered by the latia or the cold. No one spoke, for Prioress Gusalan was watching them. She seemed extra bitter today, as if the giant who had arrived last evening had set her in a foul mood. Wrapped in a black hooded wool shawl and holding a cudgel in one hand, she looked every part the witch that the Nans wove stories about to scare the children into behaving. Every boy had been on the receiving end of that cudgel. A minor offence, such as speaking out of turn, would land a blow on the thigh or hip. A worse offence, fighting amongst themselves or not working as hard as expected, could get a crack on the hand. Broken fingers, hands, and wrists were not uncommon among the orphans. The worst offence, direct disobedience of the prioress or curate Barda, could lead to a blow on the head. It was known that not all the graves in the cemetery by the western wall were of boys who had died from disease or starvation. A rumour had spread that the giant man who had stayed the night was a high-ranking Estergom official. Estergom was the mountain, the castle that clung to its rocky sides, and the realm that they lived in. The castle blocked the pass of the Ultului Gorge and was the centre of power for the Barnate. It had stood for 1,000 years as a barrier against the realm's enemies. The official seemed to have caught the curate by surprise. Usually they had several moons' notice about a visit from Estergom. The Penuries had been overheard gossiping that the old ground steward had been executed for theft, along with all his woodrunners. This was the new steward. He was different than Rake. He carried a saxe, the sheath carved with runes indicating he was once a member of the band's fanatical black regiment. Mirko had said he openly threatened both Gusalan and Barda. No one had seen Curate Barda this morning, but all the orphans expected him to be in an even fouler mood than the prioress. He was always in a foul mood, and a surprise visit from the ground steward would not help. When he was ill-tempered, the beatings usually increased, and he was quick to deal discipline with the knotted end of his staff. They were a pitiful group, undernourished and cowed, save the one boy who stood a bit apart from the others. He never bowed his head, hunched over, or turned from a raised fist or the cudgel. He did nothing to hide his hatred of the prioress or the curate, nor they he. Try as they might, they could never subdue him. His name was Dagmar, and he came from a small village outside Adani, a fatherless child who had lived with his mother. Her name was Aiella. She made her keep as a seamstress and had earned enough to provide for a small cottage near the village square. Dagmar never spoke of her to anyone or the circumstances that led to his being sent to Malmok. 2 seasons ago, on a hot summer's eve, she disappeared. On that night, in the early evening, Dag was playing outside their cottage, chasing fireflies. He heard his mother scream from within and ran to the door. He reached to open it, but his hand stopped, as if there were an invisible barrier between the door and himself. He tried to yell, but found he had no voice. Through the door he could hear an argument. His mother was speaking angrily to a man in a raspy voice. The door was old and warped, with a wide gap between the hinges and frame created by years of rain, snow, heat, and cold. He peered through and saw a man dressed in black armour with his back to the door. "You are not welcome here, demon," said his mother, moving behind the dining table. "I have been tasked," the man in armour explained, opening his palms to her in a sign of peace. "Then you should leave here and finish your master's bidding," said Aiella angrily. "But my task is here," he smiled. "My task is you." Dag heard his mother make a low humming sound and then said, "Leave here, demon." The man winced as if he were in some pain, then smiled. "I am Tannin, and my summoner has infused me. Your childish tricks will not work on me." In a flash, he took a step towards her, pushing the table out of the way. From his throat came a low growl, a mix of beast and human, and Ayella's arms flew to her sides as if hidden ropes had bound her. A look of fear crossed her face. The demon clenched his fist, his face betraying the effort it took to keep her bound, for all magic, even to a being from the netherworld, has a cost. He breathed heavily as he said, "I could kill you here and now. Say you ran. I chased. There was an accident. The summoner has not specified your condition, only your return. It would make transporting you all the easier." But Tannin seemed troubled. He stared at Ayella, cocked his head, and took in a long, deep breath. He leaned closer, saying, "We were familiar once. I can sense it." He looked around the cottage and then demanded, "Where is the child? Your boy? I am also tasked with his return as well." "Who sent you?" his mother choked. The demon rolled its neck as if stretching unused muscles. "Dear witch, you are knowledgeable. You know I cannot reveal their name. That would give you power over my summoner and me. Now behave. Answer my question. Where is the boy?" "He is no longer here," she lied. Tannin rolled his eyes in disbelief while scanning the cottage again. "He is still here, for if he were dead, I would have known," Tannin smiled. "Where have you hidden him?" "He is not hidden," she said with confusion. The demon absent-mindedly scratched an itch under his eye. He paused momentarily, giving his finger a curious look, as if trying to understand the cause and effect of it. Then, "Your magic is stronger than I was told. My summoner said you were gifted in the healing arts. Some misperception. But you have deception skills as well." Tannin scanned the room, as if searching for something, sighing again, saying, "He has not been here for a long time. His essence no longer lingers. Tell me now, witch, where is he hidden?" A thought flashed through Ayella's mind. Now it was her turn to sneer as she lied. "He is not hidden. He is apprenticed. To the huntsman." This gave Tannin pause. He took a step backward. A memory flitted through his mind, a vision of pain delivered with forbearance. "The huntsman is a foul creature. Crossing him was not part of my summoning." He looked about the room again. "You will have to suffice." Tannin reached out and placed an icy hand on his mother's shoulder, and both witch and demon disappeared into a black mist. Dag fell back onto the ground in shock. Some time passed before he came to his senses, and, not knowing what to do, ran to the miller's cottage, for the miller had always been kind to them. He pounded on the man's door until it opened, and he was let in. Dag still could not speak, but between gasps and tears, it was apparent something was wrong. The miller, armed with an axe, and along with his two sons, took Dag back to the cottage. He was a stout man and crashed through the door, which opened without resistance. The cottage was empty, save for a slight foul odour in the air, like the swamp grass when one trod on it. The reeves were sent for, local tax collectors and deputies to the sheriff. They searched the village and the surrounding countryside for Ayella, but she was not to be found. Immediately, suspicion fell on Dag. He and his mother had always been a curiosity in the village, both tall and fair, both never ill, both never troubled by heat or cold, on a seamstress's earnings never short of food or clothing. Blessed, some had said, while others spoke of darker things. If the gods, luck, or the supernatural provided for them, it brought no harm to anyone else, and they were left to be. The constable from the nearby town was brought in, a man named Kaplon. He consulted with the village's elders and its Howman cleric, a seer. The seer, head bald, naked, painted all in black save a white stripe down his spine, using a concoction of henbane, entered the dream world to seek answers, but none were given. With no answer from the spiritual world, the village turned to the laws of man. People accused Dagmar of murder and hiding the evidence. Others argued sorcery. Kaplon knew baseless accusations of witchcraft could spiral as people found cause to settle petty grievances. The constable settled the matter by explaining a boy of 10 seasons could not kill his mother and dispose of the body without a trace. And if sorcery was involved, why not use the same to protect himself? Again, the seer was called. He was asked to open a channel to the underworld and see if the boy's mother was there. This time, using Belladonna, he travelled into his mind and Byro's realm. These visions provided some evidence. He did not sense Aella in the netherworld. The mother was not dead. People began to suspect she had abandoned him. This was a bad omen for those of the Howman faith. An orphan child was one who had offended the gods, and to harbour one would soon bring the gods' offence on them. They were sent to places such as Malmok to serve penance for whatever offence they had given until the time when they came of age and the gods would forgive them. The boy was turned over to the Reeves to watch, and eventually a decision was made to send him to Malmok. Curate Barda was touched by the gods, for he had a way of working the evil out of those in his care. On a rain-filled eve, Dag was bound, thrown in a trundle, and escorted by the constable and Reeves to the orphanage. The beating started immediately, as Barda was reciting the long list of rules of the orphanage and felt Dag was not giving him his full attention. The boy was not intimidated by the curate or any of the staff. Nothing seemed to bother him, not the beatings, terrible food, or having to work from dawn to dusk. His faith and the law had failed him. His mother was out there, captured by this demon named Tannin and whoever his summoner was. Dag's mind was singularly focused, resolved to leave this place by whatever means and rescue or avenge her. Though life at Malmok was awful, he found some enjoyment in the company of others his age. He had never had friends before. Being amongst peers, he soon realized he was faster, stronger, and could endure heat and cold better than any of the others.
2 years passed, and he grew. He was taller than those his age, and, at 12 seasons, the undisputed leader of the orphans. He had found purpose in protecting the boys, especially the younger ones. He defended them from the cruelty of the curate, prioress, penuries, and even some of the other orphans. Whenever possible, he took the blame for their mistakes and the beating that ensued. He shared his meagre food and watched over them when they were ill. The moon cycle he had arrived, 2 boys died. One of the wet cough, the other supposedly a slip on the icy pathways, cracking his skull. But the rumours were that Barda had beaten him to death for a minor offence. Boys still succumbed to illness, and the injuries continued, but none had died since that day. Dag was coming of an age when he could be considered for an apprenticeship, and they could no longer legally keep him at Malmok. He suspected the constable, and townsfolk would not let him go free, and he had begun to devise an escape. But each time he steeled his courage to leave, he stopped. He would be overtaken with guilt at the thought of leaving the other boys to the mercy of Barda. As he stood in the swirling snow, watching the others huddle together for warmth, these thoughts tumbled through his head. The door to the southern tower opened, and they all looked up to see the curate exit his quarters. A mink cloak was wrapped around his cleric's garb, and heavy leather boots reached up to his knees. He carried his staff, and hunched over from the biting wind, glowered at the boys. Behind him strode the giant man, a heavy fur cloak dyed black with yellow trim draped over him and trailed down to his knees. Thick leather boots rose to his calves, and he wore padded black clothing beneath. His thick beard and hair flew in the wind, swirling around his fur cap. A sax hung off his belt, bouncing as he walked. All the boys stared in awe. The only sound in the courtyard was the wind whipping over the walls and through the grounds. The man towered over Curate Barda and the prioress. He looked at the boys and said with authority,
"I am Master Merrick, Ground Steward of Estagom."
He turned to Barda.
"This is the lot of them?"
"Yes, there are periods when the quality of the youth around Adani and the other villages is lacking," Barda replied with a thin smile. Merrick gave him a scowl, and the curate's smile disappeared.
"Have them step forward into a line," ordered Merrick.
Barda looked at the boys, embarrassed to see his authority usurped in front of them, and snarled,
"You heard him, you louts! Step forward now, form a line."
The boys formed into a line, most of them still staring at Merrick in awe or fear. The ground steward walked down the line of youths and stopped in front of a tall, reddish-blonde boy.
"How old are you?" he asked.
The boy's eyes grew wide with fear, and he stammered,
"I do not know, sire."
Merrick looked at Barda, who shrugged. "They are orphans. It is not like they come here with a history. Who knows the birth season of every stray dog? We think he is about 13 seasons."
"Step out over there," said Merrick, nodding behind him.
The boy looked bewildered, hesitated, and looked at Dag, who gave a nod. The red-headed boy walked out of line and stood alone, wrapping his arms around himself to keep warm and hide his discomfort. Merrick noted all of this. He passed two frail-looking boys and stopped in front of the shortest in line.
"Age?" he asked.
12, replied the boy. Merrick looked him up and down.
"Can you work hard, lad?"
"Harder than anyone here," he answered defiantly, jutting his chin. Merrick let out a soft chuckle.
"Of course you can, boy. Join the other," he laughed, pointing over his shoulder with his thumb.
He continued walking and stopped in front of a tired-looking boy with wispy blonde hair. "When was the last time you ate, lad?" The boy quickly looked to the curate and then back to Merrick.
"This morning, sir. Porridge for breakfast."
"It'll take me a month to fatten you up some, but I'll wager you can fly like the wind."
"Out of line with you. Join the others."
He then stopped before Dag, who looked at him with disinterest.
"Not cold, are you?"
Dag shrugged.
"Answer your betters," hissed the prioress.
"Join the others," commanded Merrick.
Gusselin took a step forward, her voice lower now. "I'd leave this one be, ground steward. There are other boys, good boys, strong boys."
"He's trouble," sneered Barda. "You'll regret selecting him. A demon rests within him. Pick another. They'll bring you less woe."
Merrick looked at Dag and raised both eyebrows in feigned surprise.
"I'll stay," replied Dag.
Barda shifted, uneasy now.
"See, the boy is disrespectful, doesn't know his betters."
Merrick studied Barda's face. There was something there. He was not the type of man to want to hold on to a troublemaker. There is always a play with these types. He wondered what it could be with the defiant boy. Dag glanced at the other boys, many of whom looked fearful at the thought of him leaving. He turned back to Merrick, but could not form words. Merrick stepped forward and put his large hand on Dag's shoulder.
I know. But you would have to leave someday. Today is that day. Do not worry for them.
Dag looked at the other orphans one last time, then walked out of line and joined the group that had been selected. Merrick turned to Barda.
A word, curate, he said,
and walked off out of hearing range of the boys. Barda followed, hands nonchalantly behind his back, but he could not hide his nervousness.
Those boys do not look like they have been fed properly, ever, the ground steward hissed beneath his breath.
Barda said nothing at first, but then he snarled,
You come here for one day, high and mighty, and pass judgment on me. I am of the Howman. What we do here, we do per our beliefs, the same beliefs that our ban holds. Orphans are calamities of the gods, a punishment for some wrong done. Penance is required, and that penance comes through discipline. I see your sacks. You clearly want us all to know you once served the Black Regiment. Then you know more than others how discipline is needed to make the man. Do not judge me for what I do. It is to appease the gods and serve the Barnate.
Merrick drew a deep breath and then said in a quick but angry voice,
You little sack of wine. Yes, the regiment is disciplined, and punishments are harsh for breaking the rules, but we volunteer for that existence. We willingly offer ourselves as guardians of the Barnate and the Ban and accept the results of our failings. You are beating children because they lost their parents, and more so because you are a weak and petty man. As I said last evening, I would have put you on the gallows or the executioner's block. Nevertheless, you will continue to receive the Ban's graces, and you will use that charity to make this place into what it was intended, a home for boys who have already suffered enough, a place for them to grow until they can be apprenticed into work that is beneficial to the Barnate. I have enlisted the Huntsman to visit once a month and report back to me. By Perun, if he is not satisfied, he is instructed to bind you and bring you to trial in Estagom. If he feels these lads are being abused, he is ordered to strike you down where you stand. The mention of the Huntsman took all the bravado from Barda.
Mercy, ground steward, pleaded the curate. The Huntsman is evil, a shapeshifter. He and the witch he lives with, I beg you. But before he could finish, and with no warning, Merrick had placed a meaty paw on the curate's chest. Speak no ill against the Huntsman and less of his wife. They are better people than you will ever aspire to, said Merrick softly. And with that, he gave Barda a soft shove back toward the orphans and shouted, Go, clean this sty. The clock will soon strike on his first visit. He sighed to himself and then let out a low laugh. He had yet to inform Jotus of the new task he had set him. The man would, with your reason, be angry. He looked at the penury and said in a commanding voice, Bring my horses and cart and a large jar of hot broth. The penury looked to Barda, who only nodded. The lad ran off towards the barn. Merrick turned to the four boys and said, Go and get what belongings you have. Be quick about it. We have a long day's travel ahead of us.
In a short time, they all returned, each carrying a pitiful blanket and a small bag with all their possessions in the world. The cart had been brought about, and Merrick was leaning against it, holding a wooden cup. On the ground was a large jar. The ground steward picked it up in one hand and poured some steaming broth into the cup, then handed it to one of the boys.
Drink up. It is not much, but it's best to start a cold journey with a warm drink.
When all had had their fill, he motioned for the boys to climb into the cart. As the others climbed in, Dag turned and walked back to the curate and prioress.
There shall never be forgiveness between us. And at some point in future days, there shall be an accounting. If the gods are just, the rest of your lives will be of misery, and your death will be one of long suffering. He spat. Barda said nothing, but glared. The prioress hissed,
"Hold your tongue, spawn of evil. You speak to an appointee of the ban. What is done within the law."
"Hold your tongue, witch," growled Dag. "No law of men or gods allows for what you've done. I hear the huntsman will visit soon. Perhaps he shall pluck your other eye. Know this. If another grave is filled here, I shall learn of it, and I shall return and bury you two in your own."
With that, he turned and returned to the cart and climbed in. Merrick watched him with a small smile and raised eyebrows. Dag looked at him surprised, as he thought he and the curate were out of hearing distance of him when he mentioned the huntsman. The two draft horses stamped and snorted, annoyed to have been taken from the warmth of the barn. The others sat huddled against the sideboards, which offered some protection from the wind. As usual, Dag didn't seem to be bothered, and sat on the sideboard's edge, holding on with one hand and staring away from Malmok, lest he change his mind about leaving. Merrick walked over, reached up under the seat, and tossed a leather bag at the boys. "There are some old cloaks and blankets to keep you warm. Well, at least warmer than you are now." They reached into the bag and passed the cloaks and blankets around. Dag took a green one and pulled the fur-lined hood up around his head. "I am Merrick, ground steward of Estergom. That means I am in charge of all the land within and without the castle Estergom that belongs to the ban. That includes the Kosa, which we will be riding through." The red-headed boy looked up with concern and said,
"But sire, they say that forest is haunted. There are evil spirits, and if a child wanders too close, they drag you deep within. There's a witch that lives there. They give the children to her, and she gives them magic in return," said the small, frail boy.
Merrick chuckled. "What are your names, lads?"
"I am Estienne," said the reddish blonde boy. "I am Goss," said the small, wispy blonde one, "but everyone calls me Goose."
"And you?" asked Merrick to the third boy.
"Rowan," he answered softly. "Everyone calls me Ro."
"And I am Dagmar," said Dag before Merrick could ask. "But everyone calls me Dag." "Good. Now, let me tell you, the Kosa is not haunted. I have been in and out of that forest all my life, and I have never seen a ghost, a witch, or an evil spirit. And even if it were, there's not much we can do about it. The fastest road to Estergom is through it. So, it's into the Kosa for us. Cheer up, though. We will spend 2 freezing days of travel if the pain in my hip is correct, but we will be rewarded with a stay at the huntsman's cottage." The boys looked petrified at this announcement.
"The huntsman and his wife are the ones who eat children," said Rowan in a panic.
Merrick glowered and pointed a finger at the boys. "I have known Master Jotus nearly 10 seasons. There is not a finer man in the world, and there is no finer woman than Laria. Who has put such nonsense in your heads?"
"Prioress Gusalan, and at times the curate," answered Dag. "They would tell stories of orphans who caused trouble. They would tie them to a stake at night as an offering to the huntsman. In the morning, they would be gone. They would threaten the boys with the same fate if they did not behave. So that explains why Barda was terrified when I said the huntsman would be checking in on him from time to time," laughed Merrick. "They truly are terrible people, aren't they, boys?" They are nodded silently. Worry not. Terrible things happen to terrible people eventually. Then, in a sort of sing-song way, he softly chanted, "Though Pear Run turns the wheel slowly, he grinds the grain fine. With his patience, he stands waiting, with justice delivered from divine." "My father would sing that while we worked the fields," said Roe, "before he died."
Merrick smiled at the boy, climbed into the cart seat, snapped the reins, and shouted over the creak of the cart and neighs of the horses,
"Fear not, lads, for you shall feast at the table of Jotus and Laria, a blessing few men have had the joy of experiencing. And if you behave, I'll grant you each a flask of Jotus's beer, the best brewed in the barnate, bar none."
Barda watched the cart disappear down the hill. He turned and snarled at the gathered boys.
"Get your asses back inside, you lot of sards."
He turned to Guslin and said in a low growl,
"Send the doves. Let her know the boy has been taken."
"She will have our heads," hissed Guslin.
"Her, the ground steward, the huntsman, Felushi, it would seem someone is destined to take them."